Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
On a branch of a big tree sat a little bird, Peter's friend. All is quiet, chirped the bird gaily.
A little boy was the main character, but let's face it, the critters stole the show in Prokofiev's Peter and the Wolf. I'm John Schaefer, coming up on Soundcheck today, the second in our two-part series about animals and music. We'll hear about a new exhibit at the Morgan Library that explores great art inspired by wild creatures. Later... Humankind's animal instincts are on full display in Verdi's adaptation of Shakespeare's Macbeth. We'll talk with Thomas Hampson, who's playing the title role in the Met Opera's new production. All of that plus this week's Pick 3 on Soundcheck after the news. Heeding the call of the wild, even if it's from the cat in the kitchen. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. This piece is part of an ancient trend of artists finding inspiration in animals. Today we'll hear about a new exhibition exploring the relationship between artists, poets, musicians, and their creature companions. Also today, baritone Thomas Hampson brings Macbeth to the stage at the Metropolitan Opera. But we begin the second part of our two-day series on art and animals by looking to the Morgan Library and Museum, where they have a new exhibit called In the Company of Animals. The exhibition's curator is Clara Drummond. She joins us in the studio. Welcome to Soundcheck.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So yesterday, you know, we were talking with Bernie Krause, the naturalist and composer, and he was saying how, you know, his theory is that the earliest form of human music was humans imitating the sounds of animals around them.
Right.
Do you see that mimicry across the human arts?
I think, for sure, animals have been, since, you know, the earliest cave paintings, a kind of influence on human artistic endeavor and the creative process. And I think there's always been an interest. I mean, in art, there's been an interest in, like, the form of the animal as opposed to the human form, you know. Mm-hmm. There's something beautiful about, and in literature, same thing. I think birds have definitely had an influence on the rhythms of poetry and just the, so yeah, I think it goes so far back to beginning of humans and our, you know, living on this earth with animals. We can't escape them.
You think of the, you know, the paintings, the cave paintings in Lascaux. Exactly. and the other caves in the south of France, and it's all like horses and bison and
right.
stuff like that. But is it just horses and bison, or, you know, what do we learn about ourselves?
Well, that's one thing I really, that's the big question of the exhibition, thinking about this relationship with animals and what it reveals about us in it. I think for me, and especially looking at animals in art, because one of the ideas of the exhibition is that animals are everywhere, so not just in art, they're in our lives. And I remember when I moved to New York, I was thought, you know, well, that's the end of ever seeing animals, but even in New York, mm-hmm. they are everywhere. But that's the argument of the show, really, that it really is fun to, it's an interest in animals, but it really is about sort of the most human things, like the human questions, like what it is to be good, what is beauty, you know, what it is to have relationships with other creatures, whether animals or human. So, you know, those are, yeah, it's the question of the exhibition. I'm not sure I have an answer, but it's what I'm interested in asking, what it is about ourselves that is revealed in this close relationship mm-hmm. with animals. So.
Well, sometimes, you know, an exhibition is successful if it just asks the right question.
Yeah, that's always been the most interesting part to me, is like put some questions out there, because there's also so much art and music. I mean, you could fill 100 rooms in an exhibition. So it's just a starting point.
The exhibition's called In the Company of Animals. It's showing at the Morgan Library and Museum through May 20th. And we've got a slideshow of images from the exhibition on the Soundcheck page. You can check it out now at wnyc.org/soundcheck. And in addition to, you know, paintings and illustrations, you also have some poetry mm-hmm. and some musical scores.
Yes.
Including Haydn's Creation. Why?
Yes. Well, Haydn's creation was very interesting to me. Well, first of all, Morgan has a fantastic music manuscript and printed music collection. But I wanted to find instances of musical scores printed in manuscripts where there were sort of different animals were serving different functions, because that's really one of the ideas of the show. I look at animals as symbols, animals as moral teachers, animals as muses. So the Haydn's interesting because in the creation he's, you know, in music describing the creation of the world, so the creation of the beast, the creation of man, and it's an interesting attempt to depict in music that it really is mostly about the movement of the animals. So he's how to depict, he's, you know, there's a lot, there's a tiger, a stag, then a cow, even a worm. So, you know, it's again, how do you depict animals in music? And I put that in the symbol section because, you know, music is symbolic. Mm-hmm. You know, you have notes that represent tones. But in this case, it wants to be extra symbolic and, you know, describe something that's not musical, particularly in music.
So. And, of course, music becomes a little less symbolic and more tactile when actual musicians are playing
right.
those notes on the page.
Exactly.
In this case, it's Robert Shaw and the Atlanta Symphony Orchestra, a little bit of Haydn's creation.
The earth brings forth at God's command unnumbered living creatures in perfect forms and fully grown. Triumphant roaring stands the lion there. With a lightning leap, the tiger appears. Head the nimble stag. With snorting and stamping, flying mane, uprears in might, a noble steed.
Just a little bit from Haydn's creation, Robert Shaw conducting the Atlanta Symphony, and we're speaking with Clara Drummond. She's curating this exhibit in the Company of Animals at the Morgan Library and Museum here in New York. It's not just in the text; it's in the music too.
Exactly.
You know, the tiger leaps, and then the music sort
leaps.
Of leaps.
Yeah, there's like ascending runs, and
the stag bounding,
exactly.
And then the music. You know,
the staccatos of
suit.
The stag. Exactly.
Yeah.
So really, yeah, an attempt to get at that movement.
So what is the oldest piece in the exhibit? You don't have the Lascaux cave paintings.
No,
how far back do you go?
We go quite far back. The oldest piece is a Near Eastern cylinder seal from Mesopotamia, present-day Iraq, from 3100 BC, approximately.
Wow.
And the Morgan has a fantastic collection of these Near Eastern seals.
Now, what is a cylinder seal? That would have been used to like, in wax to create
You would have rolled it over clay. Mm-hmm. It really was a circle, and there was carved, like, a picture story around that. You would have rolled it over wet clay. And then the wet clay was used, I mean, again, it's kind of mysterious in many ways, but used for various things. You could latch, like, a container with it. You could latch a door, fold. The cylinder seals themselves could be worn as jewelry if they mm-hmm. were pierced. So they had many different functions. But animals are all over the cylinder seals, as you would expect. You know, they have to do with mythology and gods. And in the cylinder seal on view, there is a one-eyed hero battling various lions.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot. And again, the lion's symbolic of the chaos of the natural world, and the hero in dominating them, you know, shows his legendary strength. So
again, it's not just horses and bison, you know, these animals represent something.
Right, exactly. These have a very specific symbolic meaning.
Mm-hmm. And what is the most recent piece in the exhibition?
The most recent is actually a Jim Dine drawing called Blind Owl. That's also in the symbolics section. And he says that the owl represents the goddess of Athena. The fact that it's blind is surely a comment.
Mm-hmm.
There's also a very recent piece that I love by David Hockney, a drawing of his two dogs, Stanley and Bougie, his dachshunds. They're again curled up on a cushion, and he says you know, for him, they're his friends, and he doesn't apologize for drawing them in any way. They're as important as a mother or a lover. So
in this case, the dogs are simply dogs.
They are simply dogs, yeah. Yeah, they're just companions. I have a whole section on companions to artists and writers. So the
idea of, you know, art and animals, as we've already talked about, you know, is as ancient as art itself, as near as we know.
Exactly.
And musicians especially seem to have been drawn over the centuries to birds.
Right.
And the Alaska-based composer John Luther Adams is a sort of contemporary, you know, extension of that tradition. This piece is called, for reasons that will become immediately evident, Wood Thrush. That's John Luther Adams from a collection of pieces called Songbird Songs. And that one is called Wood Thrush. And Clara Drummond, who's curating In the Company of Animals, the exhibition at the Morgan Library and Museum here in New York, pretty clear that that is, you know, an effort to kind of portray these birds.
Yeah, transcribe. It's great. Because I've heard it's notorious. Again, I've never done this, but it can be notoriously difficult to transcribe in music exact, because birdsong is actually so complicated when you break it down into the actual sounds and rhythms. Mm. So, yeah, that was beautiful.
And yet we have classical composers going back to Clement Joncan in the medieval times who've done just
exactly.
that.
Exactly. And specific birds are, you know, cuckoos or and nightingales. And
right,
Beethoven
right.
Are
Mozart
popular.
And Stravinsky,
exactly,
respectively.
Yeah, exactly.
So when you were putting this exhibition together and you're going through all this poetry, these music scores, the paintings and illustrations, any fun facts come out in your research?
Well, in terms of music, one funny anecdote I read about, again, and you never know if how much of these are legend as opposed to fact, but there was...
But if it's a good story, share.
Right, exactly. there was a story that Wagner, when he... And I don't have a Wagner manuscript, but I read about the fact that he had a dog he was so attached to that he couldn't compose unless the dog was sitting next to him. And
yeah,
to
that
the point
sounds
where,
like Wagner.
Yeah. And he would ask for the dog to be brought in, and he would also gauge, he would, you know, play something for the dog, and if the dog... And then he would see what the expression... You know, however the dog reacted. I'm not sure you want your dog judging your music, but I guess it worked for him. So, there's a T.S. Eliot first edition on view of the Practical Cats, which of his poems are based on cats' nature, and that of course became the basis for the musical Cats, which is so famous. And that all started with T.S. Eliot's own cat, Jelly Lorum, who is a character mm-hmm. in Cats. And it's just very funny. He's like, you know, Jelly Lorum tries to be useful. He's useful by helping me with the trash because he pulls things out of the trash. And he helps me clean the curtains by, you know, ripping them down. So there's all kinds of personal connections to animals that were really interesting to read about. And just, I mean, so many of us have pets that it mm-hmm. resonates with us.
Now we just watch them on YouTube. But in the old days, we wrote poems and painted them and all kinds of stuff. Soundcheck listeners, lots of art about birds, about cats. But what animal has been underrepresented in art and deserves a musical treatment? You can leave a comment on our webpage, wnyc.org/soundcheck, where you'll find the slideshow of... some of the things at the exhibition called In the Company of Animals at the Morgan, wnyc.org/soundcheck, or give us a call, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Again, online, wnyc.org/soundcheck. An animal that's been underrepresented in art and deserves better from a songwriter or a composer somewhere. again, Clara, you did a lot of research on this. I mean, were you surprised at how many of one animal or how few of another you found?
Well, with music, of course, it's true. The bird, I mean, it makes absolute sense that birds, yeah, I mean, yeah, they actually produce sounds and music. In terms of literature, I have a grasshopper in the show, which I was very, because even if you would call that an animal, there may be some debate. But I have the E.E. Cummings poem.
Who would debate that a grasshopper is not an animal?
Well, I don't know, insect. It's an animal. I have the E.E. Cummings poem Grasshopper, where, you know, he plays with punctuation and the letters of grasshopper are mixed up, and then at the end the grasshopper leaps and it becomes grasshopper. So, and I even have a lizard, a huge 17th century lizard in the show, mm-hmm, a monitor lizard. Those tend to be underrepresented.
I guess a lot of people, you know, when they think of art and animals, especially kids, will think of Peter and the Wolf, the Prokofiev.
I did.
Is that,
I remember playing the record over and over again. It's like one of my earliest childhood musical memories, really being obsessed with it. And I will forever associate French horns represent the wolf. I will basically be terrified every time I hear a French horn. My mother played French horn for a while, which probably adds to my my nervousness around that instrument.
Sorry, Mom. Yeah. We're speaking with Clara Drummond. She is curating In the Company of Animals at the Morgan. And in this scene from Prokofiev's Peter and the Wolf, in the David Bowie narration, the bird and the duck have been discussing exactly what makes a bird a bird, and the cat sees her chance to pounce.
The cat thought, the bird is busy arguing. I'll just grab him. Stealthily, she crept towards him on her velvet paws. Shouted Peter, and the bird immediately flew up into the tree.
Peter and the Wolf, Sergei Prokofiev, and Clara, this is the David Bowie version with Eugene Ormandy and the Philadelphia Orchestra. That's the one
That's the one we used in the show for the audio section to listen to.
The show is In the Company of Animals, showing at the Morgan Library and Museum through May 20th. There's a slideshow of images from the exhibition on our webpage, wnyc.org/soundcheck. Where Linda asks, is there any music about guinea pigs, sugar gliders? I don't even know what a sugar glider is. Other cute, unusual pocket pets. I think Linda's just making stuff up towards the end of that. But, I mean, you know, little... Like,
yeah.
Are there poems about guinea pigs or hamsters or gerbils or medieval illuminations? Anything?
I'm sure there are medieval illuminations of everything. We have medieval illuminations of pretzels in our collection, so they're probably. And someone, a woman came in and said she swears that the first dog treat, like, you know, the little bones, she also saw in one of our medieval manuscripts. So I would not be surprised if there are hamsters in some medieval manuscripts.
Now, another surprising thing that comes out of your exhibition or the research into your exhibition, Edgar Allan Poe's raven was almost what?
A parrot.
that just would not Which have had the same kind of gothic...
Exactly, darkness and foreboding nature. No, we have on view the earliest surviving portion in Poe's hand, so it's in his own handwriting, where he makes some revisions to a stanza of the raven. But he said in an essay about writing that, you know, I needed a bird that could speak, because, you know, the bird says nevermore.
Right.
And, of course, a parrot came to mind, he said. But it was not keeping with the intended tone, so I decided on a raven. Because, imagine if it was called the parrot. It would just not work.
I cannot imagine Lou Reed taking on Edgar Allan Poe's The Parrot. The raven, on the other hand...
Just one epithet I muttered as inside I gagged and shuddered when with manly flirt and flutter in there flew a stately raven. Sleek and ravenous as any foe, not the least obeisance made he, not a minute's gesture toward me of recognition or politeness, but perched above my chamber door, this foul and salivating visage insinuating with its knowledge, perched above my chamber door, silent sat and staring, nothing more. askance, askew, the self-said fancy smiles at you, I swear, at this savage, vicious countenance it wears. Though you show here, shorn and shaven, and I admit myself forlorn and craven, ghastly grim, an ancient raven wandering from the opiate shores, tell me what thy lordly name is, that you are not nightmare sewage, some dire powder drink or inhalation framed from flames of downtown lore. Quoth the raven, nevermore.
So that is The Raven, as Edgar Allan Poe ultimately ended up writing it, thinking better of The Parrot.
Right.
Lou Reed is one of many people who's sort of taken a crack at that. I'm not sure who the narrator there was. Might sound a little bit like Willem Dafoe, but who knows. But anyway, so we're talking about animals and the arts. It's the subject of Clara Drummond's exhibition at the Morgan called In the Company of Animals. And we've put out the question, you know, what animals are underrepresented in the arts? And we've got a couple of answers. And Darren is joining us on the line from Astoria, Queens. Hi, Darren.
Hey, John. How are you?
Okay. What animal is not getting the love it deserves?
Well, definitely the platypus, without any question. It's just the funkiest animal on the face of the planet.
Now, it's got
a lot going on. It's just, you know, you could take so many different avenues for inspiration. It's confused about its identity. It doesn't know if it's a duck one moment or an aquatic bird or a land-roving, poisonous claw-wielding,
right,
dangerous beast. And so, you know, I can really see a lot of inspiration for artists from this one animal.
And what genre would this be? Would you want to hear a song, a poem, see a painting? What would your...
I think Paul McCartney would be the best one to take this. If, you know, we try to do it on the next album project, which I'm sure is going to be coming out in the next 2 or 3 months at the rate he's putting out stuff now. But I'm thinking, you know, like sort of a Live and Let Die or a Band on the Run, where he's got, you know, four songs rolled into one. And, you know, each portion of the song, like the beak movement at the intro, and then we'll have the flipper claw movement in the center, and the, you know, the poisonous spur attack at the very end, and just all kinds of fun avenues Paul could take with this.
Darren, how long have you been thinking about this? You've got this all figured out. You should go and write this piece.
Well, you know, I am the leader of the Platypus Association here in Astoria, and we haven't actually found any local specimens, but we're always on the lookout for them.
Right.
So if you do see any, I can give you our hotline number later to call in and report sighting.
All right, Darren, we'll take you up on that later. Darren calling in from Astoria, Queens. Kathy, on our website is suggesting dolphins and points out that the Maori in New Zealand supposedly wait by the shore to hear their song. Now, dolphins, there is some ancient art, like Alexandria.
Yeah, you know. Representations of dolphins. And I mean, I guess that they also, you know, make these, I mean, I've actually never heard dolphins. You know, they have that very high pitch, but you know, when they record their sounds, they're captivating. So,
Pete from Greenpoint, Pete writes, krill gets my vote. I guess Pete is a baleen whale.
Yeah, you could do the movement of krill. There's something that can be done with krill, I think.
That sounds like one
Moby
for the,
Dick,
for the
know,
late John Cage or something
yeah.
to yes. turn that into a work of art. Wayne is on the line with us from Brooklyn Heights. Wayne, welcome to Soundcheck.
Great show as usual. I wanted to talk about the terrible stereotypes of wolves in Prokofiev's Peter and the Wolf, and also in Little Red Riding Hood. These stereotypes of this shy, magnificent animal have really caused tremendous persecution of the wolf throughout history and perpetuate this horrible negative stereotype. So with all due respect to all the joy and the positiveness of this wonderful show, Peter and the Wolf is just a brutal example of how wolves get stereotyped and the power of literature and music to perpetuate these stereotypes.
That's absolutely, you know, that's right.
Yeah,
I mean, one of the great things about art is that it has that power, and of course,
that
can also be turned around.
It's a great point because it actually shows, it's very true what you say, it's not so much about representing the nature of the wolf. It's really, again, about a human, you know, unfounded fear, you know, sort of mythology of the wolf that then is taken up and perpetuated. And I think that's right. It's actually, that representation is more about humans' reaction to the wolf rather than anything about wolf's nature.
Have you come across anything that puts the wolf in a positive? Is there a Blake poem that we don't know about or something, you know, that sort of elevates the wolf? I mean, there is Paul Winter, the sax player, is a big fan of wolves and has used wolf songs and wolf calls in his own piece.
Right. You know, I can't think of anything. I mean, there tend to be more natural history depictions there of wolves, which are just meant to be more didactic, you know, just describing rather right. than reading all these human sort of emotions and actions into, you know, that the wolf is somehow, you know, ravenous. Of course it's not ravenous. It's just, it's a wolf and it needs to eat. So, yeah.
All right,
we need some positive wolf representations.
The exhibition is called In the Company of Animals. It is showing at the Morgan Library and Museum through May 20th. There is a slideshow of images from the exhibition on our Soundcheck webpage, wnyc.org/soundcheck. Animals, the subject of what I feel is a very underrated Pink Floyd album, so we'll hear a little bit of that in the background. Clara Drummond is the curator of the exhibition In the Company of Animals. Clara, thanks for being with us today.
That's great. Thank you.
This is Soundcheck. Up next, new releases we think you just might go wild for in this week's Pick 3. And later, for opera singer Thomas Hampson, murder, ghosts, and madness are all part of a day's work. We'll talk with the baritone here in the Soundcheck studio. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Time for another Pick 3, this week featuring new releases from a Jersey hero, a New York City chamber ensemble, and an orchestra way up in Rochester, New York, which is where my guest, Julia Figueres, joins us from. She's the music director and midday music host at WXXI-FM in Rochester. Julia, welcome back to Soundcheck.
It's so nice to be back, John. Thank you for asking me.
So a little hometown pride kicking off your Pick 3 for us this week.
I would be run out of town if this weren't my number one. I would never show my face again in Rochester. You bet. The Rochester Philharmonic Orchestra has a brand new CD out, and thank you for asking me to do this on the actual release date. So, today is the release date.
Now, we should say for people who are not in Rochester that this is an orchestra that under an older name, the Eastman Rochester Philharmonic, was a pretty important orchestra for many decades in the 20th century. What are they up to these days?
Well, we still think they're pretty important. And we just changed music directors. Ariel Remmerite began this year. And after 13 years at the helm, Christopher Seaman stepped down. So this is sort of his kiss goodbye
swan
as
song.
Music director. Mm-hmm. His swan song. He chose two of his favorite pieces by his favorite composer, Ralph Vaughan Williams, and created this Harmonia Mundi CD. It's a live recording, but there will be no obnoxious applauding at the end of each piece, so you don't have to worry about that guy who always stands up and yells, bravo. That's not going to happen here. But he chose a London Symphony and Serenade to Music, and this... Even as a fangirl, I have to tell you, this is a wonderful CD. They did a great job. They really did. He has so much love, and the orchestra clearly returns it to him.
Let's hear a little bit of Christopher Seaman, now the conductor laureate of the Rochester Philharmonic, and this new recording of Vaughan Williams' Serenade to Music.
Thank you.
Just a little bit of the Serenade to Music by the English composer Ralph Vaughan Williams in a new recording from the Rochester Philharmonic and Christopher Seaman conducting. It also features Vaughan Williams' London Symphony, and that's kicking off Julia Figueres' pick three for us this week. She's up at WXXI in Rochester. Although, as we move along, your next pick is from our backyard. Tell us about The Knights.
This is really interesting project. It's on Laura St. John's, Laura St. John's Ankelagen label.
Laura St. John is herself a very well-known violin soloist.
A fabulous violinist, and she has her own label, and she records on it, but she records other people on it as well. So this group, The Knights, have put out this CD on her label that is called A Second of Silence. They describe it as music that hovers. And inside they write, dissolution into silence remains their ultimate object. And it really does capture this hanging music that is everything from Philip Glass to Schubert to Morton Feldman. It's really, and Eric Satie, of course. And it is. It's music that hovers. And that's why I love this. It brings you to a place and just carries you along. It's just a lovely CD and a terrific performance as well.
Let's hear a little bit of Franz Schubert's song, Des Baches Wiegenlied, originally from his song cycle, Die Schöne Müllerin, in an arrangement and performance by The Knights. Some music from Franz Schubert, originally from his song cycle Die Schöne Müllerin. Here, an instrumental arrangement and performance by The Knights, a string ensemble here in New York. They're actually going to be the ensemble in residence at our sister station, WQXR, on April 3rd and 4th, and also performing for our listeners in Detroit on Monday, April 9th, at a Detroit Symphony Orchestra-sponsored performance at the Music Box. Their new record called A Second of Silence is on Julia Figueres' pick three for us this week. And a little bit of a left turn as we get to number three on your list. Are you a longtime Bruce Springsteen fan or a recent convert?
Oh, I am. I've been listening to Bruce Springsteen for so long. The first time I heard him, I just come home for my freshman year. And my friend David Beyer, who went to Swarthmore, said, you've got to hear this guy. He's playing our spring fling, and he's awesome. And he played me Bruce Springsteen's first two albums, Remember Albums.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been a love affair ever since. I just adore him, and his new CD, Wrecking Ball, is fabulous. It's everything it's supposed to be.
It's also, you know, a little poignant to hear, like, you know, Clarence Clemens, the big man with the big sax solo, you know, having passed away recently. Last time that we're going to hear the two of them working together. We hear them together in this song called Land of Hope and Dreams, right?
Oh, yes. And when that sax kicks in, and you know it's Clarence, it's a heartbreaker, and yet it lifts you up too.
Julia Figueres is music director and midday music host on WXXI 91.5 in Rochester, New York, with our pick three this week. Julia, nice speaking with you again.
Thanks for having me back, John.
This is Soundcheck. Up next, baritone Thomas Hampson brings his portrayal of Shakespeare's Macbeth to the Metropolitan Opera this week. He's up next on Soundcheck.
Is this dream? Carry saints and sinners. vado in fiamme in pollicana dalla rocca di mattuto figli sposo a figli spara scorre sangue a me.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Now look, I don't have a whole lot of time to be out on Facebook, but yesterday I was troubled by a Facebook status update that the baritone Thomas Hampson posted. Let me read it to you. By 11 a.m., I murdered a king. A little while later, I was crowned king, had a friend killed, saw ghosts, drove my wife into madness and death, and finally got stabbed. And you thought you hated Mondays. Luckily, it all happened in a dress rehearsal for Verdi's Macbeth at the Metropolitan Opera. Thomas Hampson is singing the title role there, starting this Thursday evening, and joins me here in the studio now. Thomas, welcome back to Soundcheck.
How are you? Yes. Good. Everybody's dead. I'm off today.
So, that Facebook status pretty much summed it up. Macbeth is, in any form, a really dramatic story. Is that what attracted you to it?
Well, look, it's one of the great operas. It's one of the great stories. It's one of the great dilemmas of ambition and evil. And what I think is sort of the key for Macbeth in terms of all those evil and abject stories of evil that you play in the opera or as a baritone. The thing about that is so compelling about Macbeth is this idea of decision. You know, he's tragic because he decides. Whatever his weakness is or his ambition is, it is premeditated in a much more maybe even realizable sense than, say, Iago, which seems to be a sort of a realization of that dark, evil side of human nature.
So there's a suggestion that Macbeth has the possibility of something. He could make other choices and not be such a schmuck.
Well, in fact, that's, I think, is this rather enigmatic aria at the end, in the fourth act, when he says, you know, pity and respect and love could have been mine. It's what the end of a life should bring, the embracing of your fullness of life. And in fact, I've abrogated that. In fact, probably even more to the point of the decision of Macbeth, it's that the family Macbeth, these two terribly derailed human species, abrogate nature. They kill nature. I mean, obviously, murder is the killing of the natural progression, but it's in a succession of life. It's children. It's life. It's their community. It's the succession of their kingdom. You know, it's a willful abrogation of the way life should go forward.
So when Macbeth sings this aria at the end, you know, pity, respect, love. Are we supposed to pity him? Should there be some feeling of, God, I wish he had been a nicer guy?
I wonder. I'm not sure. I think what I hope, and I think what makes Macbeth so compelling, both in the theater and on the opera stage, is that it's one of those very dramatic and complex stories that we actually can truly identify with. We can see, there for the grace of life go I. And I think maybe that aria has that impact.
We're speaking with the baritone Thomas Hampson, and he's been talking about this particular aria, Pietà, Rispetto, Amore, here sung with the orchestra of the Age of Enlightenment. Thomas Hampson singing Pietà, Rispetto, Amore from Giuseppe Verdi's opera Macbeth. I know he's a bad guy, Thomas, but how do you hate someone who sings like that?
Yes, but this is the genius of Verdi. And this is what I just adore about anything I do in the repertoire of Verdi. Verdi has this and you know, it sounds so trite to say amazing ability. I don't know how any way else to say it. It just, to me, when I hear these characters, I hear the psychology. When I hear Leonora in the third act or fourth act of Trovatore, I hear her heart. You know, I hear Germont. I hear his pain. I hear his ambivalence. Whatever it is, it's just extraordinary to me how Verdi is able to capture in musical language, and that's perhaps a very powerful thing to remind people, that it is a language. Music is a language. And in my humble opinion, the opera art form is a musical art form in a theatrical context. The power of our assimilation of what happens to us in a three-hour period is certainly equally in the power of the language of music, if not predominant. And I say it's predominant because every breath I take on the stage is by Mr. Verdi. Mm-hmm. It is not by Mr. Shakespeare. It's not by anybody else.
Well, now, I wanted to ask you about that. You started by saying Macbeth is a great story, but Macbeth in the Verdi opera is not necessarily the same story as Macbeth in the original Shakespeare.
John, huge point. And that was, even when you introduced, you know, he's singing Shakespeare's Verdi's Macbeth and so on. There is no opera, regardless of it being based on a very, very famous and complete in and of itself play, that is a musical setting of the play. It would be a disservice to both Verdi and Shakespeare. It would also be completely disorienting to have people coming to the opera saying, oh, well, we're going to hear the play. And oh, good, it's set to music. That's not the point. The stuff of the story and the to me, the compelling part is, and even Hamlet, which is a dicey last 45 minutes of an opera. It doesn't really work out, but it's a great opera. Verdi loved it from Ambroise Thomas. But the point is, what these composers do with their librettos to accentuate or condense or pick out the salient thrust of what that dilemma is, it's in the play, and turn that into an opera, I think is very powerful and very compelling.
So how different is the story in the opera from the original play?
Well, there's a lot less words.
And they're in Italian.
Now, the Italian is different words. It's not an Italian translation of Shakespeare. It's a libretto based on. I think that the cast of characters is obviously reduced. The by nature, when you have an operatic form of a great play, the storyline is going to be condensed. You're going to get through a different evolving of the characters because, one, of the language of music, and two, the convention of time in the theater. And it's a different convention.
So this is something that it seems like Verdi tried early on, and then it seems almost as if, looking at his career, he said, wow, all right, Shakespeare, I'm going to need to come back to this later. And he does. His last two operas are Falstaff and Othello. But this was an early opera by him.
This is another part of the story. You know, it was interesting. I did this production in Chicago last year, and I went right from Chicago back to Zurich and did I Masdanieri. And we all sort of, you know, you look at the chronology of Verdi's operas, and you see that Masdanieri comes after Macbeth. And you think, well, how in the heck is that possible? You know, because it's just not anywhere musically as developed as Macbeth. And it turns out that Macbeth was written second. Masdanieri was done first, but Macbeth was premiered first. And you can hear that makes a lot of sense when you look at Francesco's Sonnambula scene in the last part of I Masdanieri, because this is obviously a theatrical language that Verdi is coming to in 1847, 1848. And it is a true tectonic shift in musical, theatrical language and structure for opera. And it's an astounding piece of music. And what I find very compelling are the pieces that Verdi went on and kept writing, and we have the Rigolettos, and we have the Fortas, and we have the Trovatores, and then he starts heading in the direction of the Don Carlo, and then he comes back and revisits a couple of those middle pieces or pieces that we're introducing, like Van Masdanieri or like Boccanegra. In the meantime, he's done French versions of these other operas, so this tool chest is getting very, very rich, and I don't know of any revisit by Verdi of his pieces that they aren't compellingly better.
Did he revisit Macbeth?
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. In fact, what you were playing, the Ove Sonio, the aria, is actually the original 1847 version. It became then a duet of rather pithy, dramatic edginess in the third act, in the later version.
So when you begin playing Macbeth on stage at the Met this Thursday, it'll be the later...
Practically you only ever hear the revised versions.
Thomas Hampson sings the title role in Macbeth by Giuseppe Verdi this Thursday, March 15th, until Monday, April 9th, and you can find a link to performance dates and times on our webpage, wnyc.org/soundcheck. You know, in the theater, there's all of these famous superstitions about Macbeth. You know, you can't say
not
the
just
name.
Macbeth.
Well, yeah. But, I mean, in the case of Macbeth, you can't say the name. Mm. You can't quote any lines from it inside the theater itself. Are any of those superstitions in play in the opera world?
I think they used to be. In fact, other superstitions as well. We've gotten terribly boring in modern times. you still meet some of the old guard who you'll say, "Oh yes, I'm doing Macbeth," and they kind of their eyes widen, and like you've just said, "I shot my mother and dragged her behind the truck" or something.
Or it's like you've said, "Hey, you're in the middle of pitching a no hitter."
Yeah,
exactly. In the dugout.
or "Hey, two more strokes and you've got a 59 or something. Whatever. Exactly. It's like that. But we don't carry these two things too much on hard on sleeve.
In addition to the Italian repertoire, the German repertoire that you've sung so well for so long, you're also known, Thomas, for performing American songs, both from the Great American Songbook and from the perhaps lesser-known American art song tradition.
Well, I appreciate that, and there is a difference. The American Songbook has pretty much fallen into our development of the notion of popular music. My bailiwick, if you will, if that's a word we even use anymore, is my passion is poetry that is set to music, where you really have a strong dialogue of two metaphorical worlds, if you will, the metaphor of word and the metaphor of sound. And I've always been amused by this struggle with people of, is it first the word and then the music, or the music and the word? And so that's probably a question or even an answer to a question that doesn't need to be asked. The brilliance of art song or classic song, as we are coming more to talk about it, is literally a unique art form of song that is born of two independent art forms of themselves. And I think that's a richer way to look at it because it invites us into different layers of memory, collective or even subconscious.
So no matter how well... Rodgers and Hammerstein worked together. It's a different animal than, say, Schubert and Goethe, where the poetry pre-exists and then the musician comes along and sets it.
Yes, and it's not by any means pejorative. It's not by any means
different.
Qualitative. It is the difference between lyrics or texts or show music. Compelling storytelling, although storytelling is obviously in classic song as well. You don't even have to go to Schubert and Goethe. Let's look at Ned Rorem and Walt Whitman. That's a perfectly contemporary discussion of what this is about. And what I have found so overwhelming in this whole new look at American culture, this history of American culture through the eyes of our poets and the ears of our composers, is that we open a unbelievably rich landscape of creativity in the very complex thing we call American culture. And we, I think, give our creative personalities more credit for what they were trying to do, and that is to tell the story of being in or of America.
Well, and appropriately, last month when you were at the groundbreaking ceremony for the Smithsonian National Museum of African American History and Culture down in D.C., Thomas Hampson actually sang an American art song by the African American composer William Grant Still.
Morning angel, with heartstrings wailing, for one who in death's all stars. Morning angel, silence your wailing and raise your head from your hands. We is training the white dove.
That is my guest, Thomas Hampson, singing live at the groundbreaking ceremony for the Smithsonian National Museum of African American History and Culture in Washington, D.C. That was last month, February 22nd. And Thomas Hampson sings the title role in the Metropolitan Opera production of Macbeth from this Thursday, March 15th, until Monday, April 9th. A link to performance dates and times is on our webpage, wnyc.org/soundcheck. And Thomas, you know, there's a lot more where that came from in terms of William Grant Still.
Oh, my goodness, what a great composer.
So maybe more from you down
the road? Oh, absolutely, absolutely. One of my favorite composers. Well, and I must say, I want to say that whole celebration, that whole opening, the ceremonies, who spoke and how they spoke, it was just a wonderful, wonderful morning.
Well, and you were saying before how, you know, differentiating between the Great American Songbook and classic or art song doesn't mean one is better than the other. And as if to prove the point, in the background, here's Thomas Hampson singing a Cole Porter tune, Two Little Babes in the Wood. Thomas, great to have you back with
us
on Soundcheck.
It's great to be here. Thank you so much.
Tired businessman to see.
Thomas Hampson, he will be honored by the Met Opera Guild at a Master Singers discussion and performance on Thursday, March 22nd at the K Playhouse. And that's going to do it for Soundcheck today. For the rest of the week, the jazz bassist Christian McBride will be guest hosting Soundcheck. Tomorrow, he'll be joined by NBA great Kareem Abdul-Jabbar to talk about the new documentary On the Shoulders of Giants, which tells the story of the Harlem Wrens, an all-black basketball team based in New York during the Harlem Renaissance. And Christian McBride talks to one of his own musical icons when Allman Brothers bassist Oteil Burbridge stops by. That's tomorrow on Soundcheck. Our technical director is Irene Trudell, the program produced by Katie Bishop and Greta Cohn. Our senior producer is Joel Meyer, and we had help today from Chris Nolan. I'm John Schaefer. This is Soundcheck.